You're listening to Salmon Farming Inside and Out, a podcast series brought to you by Aquaculture North America. This podcast is sponsored by Imperial 75, a cargo-branded feed product. As a high-purity, high-protein corn concentrate, Imperial 75 gives you more freedom to formulate, more freedom to innovate, and the power to achieve more. Find out more at imperial75.com.
Hi, and welcome back to the Salmon Farming Inside and Out podcast. Thanks for joining me. This is episode 3 of season 2, and we're back to what we did in episode 1, and that's we're going to travel internationally. We're not going to go too far this time. While I'm based in Canada, we're only going to travel down to the U.S. Virtually, so we're going to save you air miles and talk to representatives of the National Aquaculture Association to learn the latest and greatest of what's happening in America. They have a lot of aquaculture happening in America, over 5,000 aquaculture farms in the country, farming over 1,500 different aquatic species. And you would think that means that they are producing, a glut of seafood, but they also have a $17 billion seafood trade deficit. They import a lot of seafood. So it's going to be an interesting conversation with the National Aquaculture Association. And as we've done before, just to get a question from a younger demographic, we've invited a member of the Young Salmon Farmers of BC, and that is Sam Tomkinson. She's a co-director at Young Salmon Farmers of BC. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Just quickly, if we can, you're young. You're part of the Young Salmon Farmers of BC, and now that you have a whole career ahead of you, where may it take you in the future?
So I originally started out in Ontario. I did 4 years of university, and unfortunately that doesn't get you very far nowadays. You need more practical experience and hands-on work. So I found myself at Fleming College in Ontario, where I did my aquaculture kind of certificate there. That kind of brought me into aquaculture. I've always been interested in kind of water ecology and fish. I did a lot of invertebrate anatomy classes. So really just never really thought of aquaculture as a career path until I started that Fleming course. I knew that would also get me out of Ontario and somewhere else onto a coast with an ocean, which I really, really wanted to do from the time I was little. So doing that course at Fleming kind of catapulted me out to BC, where I worked on a farm for a bit. And then I found my way into the office and currently work in the regulatory world. So it keeps me very, very busy. So with that, I would like to stay in regulatory. I really like that world and that way of thinking. And I do see myself in more leadership roles. I do like to take on all that kind of stuff. I really like what I do with the young professionals as well, and really bolstering and helping bring up young people in this industry is something I really look forward to doing, and it brings me joy. So it's kind of where I see myself going forward in the future.
Good. And short plug for the Young Salmon Farmers of BC. If you haven't seen their socials, please check it out. They do know how to communicate. So well done. And you've managed to alienate our Ontario listeners as well by saying you just wanted out of Ontario. No offense to Ontario listeners. So we're traveling down to the United States today. We're going to talk to the National Aquaculture Association from a young demographic, a young salmon farmer. What question should I ask them?
So a lot of polls suggest that the younger demographic is more open to aquaculture. And that's been my experience as well when I go out in public and speak with younger demographic and friends and family, the more openness of aquaculture. So my question would be, how can the younger generation bolster the job force in America?
Well, wonderful, Sam. I'll be sure to ask the question. Thanks for joining me here, and off we go to America. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ian.
Welcome to the podcast, two veterans of the salmon farming industry, two Americans on each side of the coast, I believe. They'll let us know where they're located. But today we have Sebastian Bell, who's the president of the National Aquaculture Association in the U.S., and also past president Jim Parsons. So we've got a wealth of knowledge to talk about America. It's a big country. There's lots of people. They eat some seafood. Looking at the stats, and we talked about this in the intro, there's a seafood deficit going on in the United States, and we'd like to talk about that as well. Lots to talk about. Let's start with Sebastian, just for introductions. Can you tell us, a bit about yourself, your position, your interest in aquaculture?
Sure. Thanks, Ian. I started as a commercial fisherman in 1976 and fished offshore for a bunch of years, and then became interested in aquaculture as a fisherman who was watching the stocks that I was fishing decrease pretty dramatically. So I went to university, got a degree in fishery biology, and then went overseas to Norway in the early 80s and learned my trade as a salmon farmer in Norway. And then came back to this country. Great experience for a young man at the time. Was given opportunities to work all over the world in a very interesting sector, and have never regretted it. It's a great sector.
And you've obviously taken the step into the National Aquaculture Association. Is that a new thing for you? Have you been a part of the association for a while?
I've been on the board for many years, and Jim will appreciate this. I think each of us on the board kind of decide to do our stint and step up and be president. It's a kind of a rotating thing. The National Association has really evolved quite dramatically, I would say, in the last 5-8 years. And that's been a good thing. As the industry has evolved, the association has evolved as well.
Lovely. So yeah, Jim, what about you as past president? What's your interest and an entry into fisheries and aquaculture?
My interest in aquaculture, I was an early disciple, actually, of Jacques Cousteau. And I can remember back in the late 60s, he kept talking about how we had to give up this hunting in the sea and start farming, right? And for a kid growing up in San Francisco, that somehow made total sense to me. So that's how the interest came. I started out with some small smolt growing companies for the ocean ranching projects that were here on the West Coast out of Oregon. A company called Anadromous, and then Weyerhaeuser, started working in the research group for Weyerhaeuser with coho salmon primarily. Realized we didn't know a darn thing about the genetics of the animals that we were dealing with. So I went back to grad school in genetics and a variety of aquaculture jobs after that, primarily initially in the trout industry. I took an ownership position in Trout Lodge, and we worked on developing strains of trout that were, the eggs were sold around the world. Latest efforts are working with a tribal entity here in Washington State, running their seafood and aquaculture programs. A huge interest of getting fish back in the water in Puget Sound, which I'm sure we'll talk about here today, but a lot of shellfish work too.
That's great. You mentioned ranching as well, which is a new term to many people. They're just starting to kind of understand this ranching thing. So maybe that's something we can have a chat about up in this podcast as well. What species does the National Aquaculture Association represent? I mentioned in my intro, there's about 1,500 different aquatic species that are grown in the States. But what are the main species that the association looks over?
Well, I'll start and then Jim chime in because you've been there longer than I have. But I mean, we represent virtually every species which is grown in the United States of America. And one of the interesting things about the sector in the U.S. is it is incredibly diverse. I mean, we go all the way from marine ornamentals to shellfish to seaweed to different species of finfish. A lot of research and development in new species, particularly around warm water species. Freshwater, saltwater, a lot of different production methods. And so the NAA as an association, I would suggest probably represents one of the most diverse industry sectors in the world, frankly, in terms of both its species, production methods, and size of companies. I mean, we go all the way from a very small company that's maybe one or two employees to companies that employ hundreds and hundreds of people. So it's a pretty interesting and diverse set of businesses that the association represents. The association also represents companies that provide goods and services to the sector. And that's a very important part of the value chain. I mean, it's not just, people often think about, it's just about the farms. It's not, it's about all the other companies that provide goods and services and how that multiplies the economic impact of the sector, both on the input side and on the output side. So it's not just about providing gear to farmers, but it's also about providing packaging or consulting services or accounting services, what have you, on the other side of the value chain. So it's a very, very diverse sector.
Yeah, and Sebastian, you're located in Maine on the East Coast, and Jim, you're in Washington on the West Coast. Obviously, that's kind of salmonid country, and we'll get onto that. But for all the other species, kind of where is it taking place in the States? The deep south, in the middle, along the coasts, where is the activity happening?
Well, I think there's a huge variety, Ian. I mean, obviously the catfish farming industry is located in the south, southern states. Shellfish all along the coastlines, both east, gulf, and west coasts, and a whole variety of species in between. And we're seeing more and more interest, in small mom and pop farms that are, anywhere where there's water, they're trying to grow something. So, the interest is growing, not necessarily the total production, but...
I think the most important point, though, is that there is not a state, or probably I would venture, and I may go out on a limb here, I bet there's not a county in the United States of America that doesn't have a farm, an aquaculture farm in it. And that's really representative of the diversity of the sector.
Yeah, I'll bet. And picking up on your point, Jim, the growth isn't happening. And looking at the latest stats, I think they're the latest stats. America as a country is, I think, the fourth largest consumer of seafood, fish and seafood in the world, which is quite impressive. And when you look at per capita, it's average. I was surprised, but 22 kilos a person, that's almost 50 pounds a person, sitting around 66th in the world. And, I'm from Canada, so I know Americans don't like to be 66 in the world in anything. So I imagine there's a lot of interest to grow its seafood sector. And we said off the top of the show, too, there's a trade deficit. There's you're importing 85% of your seafood to fill up a country that is fourth in the world in consumption. So there needs to be change here. So Let's talk about that. What is going on in the States to switch that balance?
I think we are third in the world in terms of seafood markets, in terms of the country, but we are 18th in the world in terms of aquaculture production. So we are way behind in terms of aquaculture production. But if you compare that to Europe, for example, Europe imports just a little bit less than percentage-wise what we import in the United States in terms of the percentage that they consume. So we're not totally alone, but, and Jim and I are both obviously representative of domestic farmers, we're not satisfied with where we're at. We want to grow the domestic sector, and both of us and the association work very hard to do that. But Jim, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this as well.
Sure. Well, I can give you a perspective, I think, that really is enlightening to me. Certainly here on the West Coast, many people are they know about the fact that in saltwater farming of salmonids has been terminated for the time being. We're going to change that. Mark my words, but for the time being, it's gone. And if you look at from, say, the years roughly 2012 to 2017, the domestic production here in Washington State for Atlantic salmon was right around 18 million pounds, 18 to 20 million pounds, with a farm gate value of $42 million, employed, literally hundreds of people, and particularly if you consider the indirect jobs. In Washington State, the commercial harvest of all salmon species was in 2021 was about 8 million pounds, and 2022 was 17 million pounds. So we outpaced not only the state of Washington, but the entire West Coast, exclusive of Alaska. I can't include Alaska in that, but California, Oregon, Washington, right around that same 18 to 20 million pounds of total salmon production from commercial catches. a very short-sighted effort to get those that production out of the water, in many of our opinions. And, you know, all that does is present an opportunity for importation of that same product. And that's indeed what happened. You know, when you look at it, I think last year, Sebastian, about $5 billion deficit in Atlantic salmon coming into the U.S. Crazy.
Yeah. So, Jim, just expanding on that, and maybe we'll go, you know, a bit larger into the country, but looking at Washington State, just for listeners that have been on the sidelines listening to this, I mean, obviously, you know, licenses were canceled, and then there was, you know, maybe some other species, finfish, salmonids. Just what is the latest, and what the heck happened there? What really happened?
You know, it's an ongoing saga, frankly, and I, you know, we just have met with the Department of Natural Resource staff that were ordered by their commissioner, who we believe is a corrupt politician, to phase out and promulgate rules to ban in-water farming in Puget Sound. And this is after the legislature actually decided that we could do it as long as it was native species. And you alluded to that. We actually switched over to triploid steelhead and had two production runs of that before the leases were canceled. It's not over yet. And the tribe that I work for currently is very interested in getting net pens back in the water in Puget Sound. So are some of the other tribes here, not all. And we believe it's a treaty right. You know, they have the tribes have a right to continue to harvest seafood, and it's not happening from the natural production systems that were once available to them. And they believe that they can do it through farming. So stay tuned. It's going to be an ongoing campaign.
So Jim, you know, yeah, granted there's been problems in Washington, and nice to hear that the story isn't concluded yet. We'll love to have you back on a podcast to tell us the good news in upcoming months or years. On the growth of aquaculture and seafood production in the States, you know, I don't know if it's a United States thing or a seafood global thing, but kind of protectionism and demarketing seems to be something that can easily confuse the consumer. You know, talking about imported species, domestic species, different types of fish, wild and farmed. Are you seeing this, and I'll ask Sebastian, are you seeing this kind of play out in the United States and confusing consumers when we talk about, you know, land-based salmon, ocean-raised salmon, different species, imported, what, tilapia versus catfish? Mm-hmm. Does it distract people from the seafood counter and, you know, they'll choose a hot dog instead?
Well, I think you put your finger on a really important issue, Ian. If you're not in the food system world or the seafood world, you probably don't know a lot about this. But the reality is seafood is the second most traded commodity in the world, right? So if you look at commodities that are going across borders and being traded across countries, seafood is a very, very highly traded commodity. And there's a lot of profit to be made around the margins in terms of defining what's good or what's bad. So we've seen lots of large foundations, lots of large nonprofits, who in my mind, frankly, are not nonprofits. They're for-profits that just hit a particular category in the tax code, who have position themselves as gatekeepers between the consumers and the producers from an opinion and marketing point of view. And so that has become very confusing for consumers. And it's not surprising it's confusing, because there are lots and lots of different sources, lots and lots of different products. It's not like you're talking about beef, right? You're talking, so in a particular protein category, you're talking about, depending on whose numbers you believe, you might be talking about 30 or 40 or 50 different products coming from 30 or 40 different countries, coming from 10 or 15 different production methods. So it's a very multi-layered product category, and it can be very confusing to consumers. And there are institutions or entities that have taken advantage of that that confusion to make a profit and to position themselves as the kind of, if you got to trust us because we'll tell you what's good or what's bad. And the large retailers, frankly, to be very blunt about it, have used those gatekeepers as a way to insure themselves against negative publicity. So they are, it is a brand protection exercise for those large retailers in particular, and for some of the large food service entities. And so from a consumer's point of view, it's not surprising that people are confused because there's so much different information out there. And so you're right. And I think at some point, consumers, because they are confused, they step away from seafood as a commodity group and go to something that's more understandable, more predictable, less risky, if you will, in their mind. And that's a challenge we have to face in the seafood sector. And it's not unique to farm product. It's true with the wild harvest sector as well. It's a common challenge for us as a seafood or protein source in the marketplace.
Yeah, the good news obviously being that there is a huge opportunity based on per capita to catch up with those other countries. So, if we can bring people confidence and consumers confidence in the seafood products they're eating, however they're raised and wherever they're from, then that's very good news for the sector.
The other thing I think, which is really good news for aquaculture, is that the issue of traceability and proof of sustainability, the aquaculture sector is in a very strong position to be able to do that. We are probably, of all the parts of the seafood world, we're probably in the strongest position of any to do that, because we do go from egg to plate. You know, if we do the right thing, if we communicate directly with consumers, with our buyers, and we are transparent about what we're doing, we've got a great story to tell. And it's a very defensible story to tell. So that's, I think that positions the aquaculture sector in a very, very strong position to kind of remove some of that confusion on the consumer perspective.
So looking to the future here, and I know that to grow its aquaculture sector, the country is looking at offshore aquaculture, and there's, NOAA is working on the file. Would like to talk about that. Just, what's the opportunity there? Where may that happen? What species? What are the challenges, and what's kind of the public discourse around it? And Jim, over to you first, because you mentioned ranching at the beginning. And when I've talked about offshore aquaculture with some people, they think Alaska and ocean ranching and salmon ranching. Can you just, because you're on that coast, tell us about the salmon ranching program, and then let's talk about offshore aquaculture if we can.
Well, certainly Alaska represents probably the largest aquaculture program in the world, if you want to look at it that way. They wouldn't necessarily admit that, but in terms of the hatchery production and the releases, certainly for species like pink salmon, it's absolutely true. We've been working as an organization even before I was president of NAA, and certainly through mine and all the way into Sebastian's efforts of trying to craft rules around offshore aquaculture that make sense for the industry, right? We're one of the things that we've had heartburn over, I guess is the right way to describe it, is that the current ideas surrounding offshore aquaculture don't include a tenure right. They don't include a lease vehicle that a farmer could predictably count on being able to stay in that one particular place. It's all based on, currently anyway, all based on a permit system that, as we've seen, certainly in Washington State, leases, while they didn't stop us or they didn't allow us to keep farming, we at least have legal recourse to go back after the government and say, you did this illegally. And so the security of tenure, I think, is an important thing that NAA has identified that we want to see in the offshore component of farming. We've looked at Magnuson-Stevens, perhaps, as a way to get it done in the Gulf. The courts ruled that that wasn't an effective way to regulate or manage aquaculture in the Gulf system. And so I think it's, you know, it's gone back to the idea of describing areas where it could be done. And it's still up in the air of how it could be done. I think, Sebastian, you think that's a fair way to describe our efforts?
I do. I think the fundamental challenge that we have, and this is not unique to the United States, I think, in fact, in you know, Canada has faced a similar challenge on the West Coast. There is a big difference between an agency that views aquaculture as a natural resource management exercise and an agency that views it as an economic development exercise. And traditionally, most fisheries management agencies are trained, and their kind of corporate culture is around fisheries management, which involves effort and access restrictions. That's how we manage, you know, traditional fisheries. In the case of aquaculture, frankly, neither of those are an issue, right? We are actually talking about, give us access to a space, and we will grow a resource that has got nothing to do with natural resources. It's got everything to do with a private company building capital assets and providing a consumer demand, serving a consumer demand. And so natural resource management agencies have a, you know, they have a really hard time adapting to that different approach. And I think that's, again, that's not unique to the U.S. Certainly we have it here, but we've seen that in other countries. The countries that have really, I would argue, expanded their aquaculture sector have viewed aquaculture as an economic development exercise. And that doesn't mean you don't have to have strict environmental laws. It doesn't mean you don't have to have rigorous constraints around ownership or all the other things that people are concerned about. It just means you have to view it differently than how you would view extracting from a natural resource a entity for commercial purposes. That's a fundamental difference. And I think there are a lot of countries that are struggling with that, but certainly in the U.S., we've struggled with that probably more than most other countries.
So along that point, I happen to, in the introduction, be speaking to a young salmon farming professional of BC. Her name's Sam Tomkinson, and I just said that I was speaking to you fellas. By the way, our tenure in the Young Salmon Farmers, that passed 30 years ago, so we could never be a member. She had asked and actually stated the fact that most surveys today are suggesting that the young demographic is very open-minded when it comes to aquaculture, and very open-minded to change, knowing what's happened in the past with commercial fisheries. So she's saying, you know, as the America looks to grow, how are they using that young demographic to help communicate to perhaps a workforce and help communicate aquaculture as it looks to grow, you know, offshore? Is that being developed and utilizing that young voice?
So you've hit on something which is really near and dear to my heart. Every year we have a regional aquaculture conference. We've been having it for 25 years. And every year, as one of the plenary presenters, I ask everybody in the room who's under the age of 30 to raise their hands. And I think the first year we maybe had 10 people. This last year we had over 650 participants and way over 50% of the people in the room raised their hand. That is what gives me encouragement here. You know, there's a lot of criticism about particular parts of the field or particular production methods. But I see a group of energized, excited young people who are going to rock the world, frankly. And they will realize the vision that Jim alluded to, that Jacques Cousteau articulated when we were all young, about exploring the oceans and using the oceans responsibly. These are the folks who are going to do it. The challenge I think we have as a sector, you know, we're all old white guys, right? The three of us here. The reality is we need to find a way to transfer our institutional learning and our institutional knowledge to that generation and mentor them so that they become the next leaders in the field. And I think that is something that both associations and individual companies really need to take a long, hard look at and really start to invest in. I think that's hugely important for our sector.
That's great to hear. Last question before we wrap things up here. It's just about the future. Just looking, 10, 20 years ahead, where does the United States want to be in aquaculture? Not just production, but species as well. Will we see anything new, over the next decade or two? Where will it end up? Jim, what about you?
Certainly, we've spent some time as an organization on looking at development of new species, in particular for our group is sablefish. But a lot of the new species development, I think, will decidedly remain efforts at finding new niches, right, that can fill demand at certain times of the year when either wild fisheries are not fishing or are declining. And as we've seen, there's a huge growing interest in both shellfish and seaweed production, yet to be understood what we're going to do with all that seaweed. I keep telling my seaweed guys that, all you need to do really to grow seaweed is put a net pen in the water, and then you can grow more seaweed than you ever care to see. But, I do think there are some developing species also in freshwater, certainly around warm water species that are beginning to capture folks' interests. Again, I don't see them becoming huge part of our overall portfolio compared to, say, salmon and catfish or oysters and clams in this country, but I think they'll become an important part, and especially for young farms starting out, that they may be a good entry point for people.
Wonderful. Well, that's it's going to be fun to follow. Jim, Sebastian, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge, everything going on in the United States. We certainly appreciate you coming on our podcast and sharing with our audience, and all the best, and hopefully catch up with you in the future.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Salmon Farming Inside and Out. If you have a comment on today's episode or would like to suggest a topic for future episodes, connect with Aquaculture North America on Twitter, now known as X, or through our LinkedIn and Facebook pages. This podcast is sponsored by Imperial 75, a Cargill branded feed product. As a high purity, high protein corn concentrate, Imperial 75 gives you more freedom to formulate, more freedom to innovate, and the power to achieve more. Find out more at imperial75.com.